Welcome to the MS News Today podcast. I'm your host, Jen Powell, and I also have secondary progressive multiple sclerosis. I am a columnist with MS News Today at multiplesclerosisnewstoday.com. Thank you all for listening to this podcast. Let me invite you to join our MS forums. We have over 1,000 active members discussing common themes and sharing their experience on living with multiple sclerosis. Please consider joining. You can find the link to the MS News Today forums in this episode's description. Welcome to the Multiple Sclerosis News Today podcast. I'm your host, Jen Powell. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Tim Coetzee, Chief Advocacy, Services, and Science Officer at the National MS Society. The National MS Society exists because there are people with MS. Their vision is a world free of MS. Everything they do is focused so that people affected by MS can live their best life. And I can't think of a better introduction. And it's a pleasure to have you, Tim.
Oh, it's great to be with you today, Jen.
Yeah, you are the Chief Advocacy, Services, and Science Officer at the National MS Society. That's a mouthful, especially for me with dysphagia. Can you elaborate for our listeners what that encompasses?
Sure. And it is a mouthful, so I can appreciate the challenge. So my role at the Society, which is just a privilege to have, is, you know, I am part of the Society's CEO leadership team. So that's the individuals that report to our CEO, Cindy Zaghi-Boilo, and a member of our, what we call our senior leadership team. So the people who have responsibility day in and day out for the organization. My specific portfolio of responsibilities is, you know, a bit as they sound. So the team that leads our nationwide advocacy program, you know, led by Barry Talenti and a nationwide team of professionals who advocate every day for state and federal policies that, you know, address access to high quality healthcare issues, all of that is one team. There's a what we call our services team, which encompasses the work of our MS Navigator program, which I know that, you know, MS News Today has written about, and all of the supportive programs that we provide and develop and provide for people with MS, things like our Facebook social learning group, like I said, our MS Navigator program, the production of experiences, educational experiences like our Black MS Experience Summit, and later this year, a Hispanic Latinx summit that we're focusing on, and other educational content, as well as, you know, creating materials and information for things like our Facebook social learning community, our online community that we call the Mighty, all of that. And then in addition, I have responsibility in our scientific domain as well. And so that's all of our research programs, the grants program that supports innovative research, all of our fellowship programs that are for training the next generation of scientists and physicians and researchers, the development of our Pathways to Cure strategy. And within that also, responsibility internationally for the work of the International Progressive MS Alliance, which I'm deeply involved with, along with other international efforts. And so all of those five department, you know, areas of responsibility, you know, feed up to me. My role as a leader is to help integrate all of that, because we as an organization really believe that it's not about, you know, individual groups working, but really how we work together holistically. And so my responsibility is to look across those and to help ensure that we're focused, that we're working together in a disciplined manner, and then also creating a consistent and clear sort of narrative about what's the work that we are doing for people with MS. How do we support people with MS? And really, at the end of the day, it's how do we change the journey that each person with MS is living on, and what role do we play in changing that journey so that it's, you know, everyone can live powerfully and effectively.
That's amazing and inspiring. And I think it helps the individual who has multiple sclerosis and who feels isolated, mm-hmm. know that there are people fighting not just for the individual through your programs, but on a greater scale to create change in the disease overall on a scientific level. Yeah. You have been interested in the field of MS since graduating with a degree in molecular biology in 1993, joining the National MS Society in 2000. Is there a particular driver for your focus on MS?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, so when I graduated with my degree I was studying mRNA before anybody really knew what mRNA was. A long time ago, long time ago, I was studying mRNA, and I was interested in at that time understanding how mRNA, which is really important for the life and health of cells, it's not just for a vaccine strategy anymore. I was interested in how those molecules got transported inside cells from one place to the other in the nervous system in the brain. So that's how I got interested in the brain. And I happened to go do my postgraduate training. So one of the things about getting a PhD, you know, a bit like when you get an MD, you have to go on, yes, you're a doctor, but you have to do a residency to become a specialist in something. In the scientific disciplines, you end up having to do post-PhD work. We call them postdoctoral fellowships. Before you can become a university professor, which was what my career aspiration at the time was. My postdoctoral fellowship work was at a laboratory in the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and they were funded by the MS Society. And so that was my introduction to MS. So I went to that lab primarily wanting to be a brain scientist, not really thinking about MS, because at that point I didn't have any personal connections to the disease. The things that affected my family, they were affected by other things, but not the brain at that point. But I started working there, and because of the funding of the MS Society for that lab, I then, had the opportunity to pursue funding for my postdoctoral fellowship training. And that's how I got connected to the society as a researcher. And then through that, got connected to people in the Eastern North Carolina chapter at the time. After my fellowship training, I moved to the University of Connecticut to take a faculty position there prior to joining the society. And that's where I got connected to more people with MS in the local chapter, doing various chapter events. And that's sort of my journey. I would say, when you talk to MS researchers, about half of them are like me. They're people who were more or less curious about science and the brain, and MS was a disease they sort of fell into as a result of, the curiosity of the brain. And then another half these days are more on the camp of they actually have a person, they either have a friend, a family member, or someone like that who personally brought them to the disease. But now I would say, after 21 years at the MS Society, I have a lot of personal connections and personal friends that I know live with MS through the society and other areas, and I'm very passionate about changing the journey for people with MS. It's changed so much in the since I started in the field in 1993, and I just I'm excited by what we are able to do for the next few years.
Well, we're very lucky to have you, because it's people like you that keep us hopeful. And that must have been incredibly interesting to see your passion for biology and science in a practical application with someone with multiple sclerosis and how you can impact that.
Yeah, it's interesting you say it that way, because it took me, I'm a science nerd, as my colleagues like to tell me even though I haven't been in the lab in a while, but it was really as I started moving and understanding and seeing how, the funding we provide to scientists like me, I was studying some very basic things in the brain with the society fellowship. But then I began to see how, okay, that affects this, and then it affects this over here. And then what I'm seeing, and particularly what excites me about the future, is what I'm starting to see more and more is how our scientists and our clinicians are thinking about the specifics of the disease, but then also how that can change someone's life, and then how we can ensure that, if we get this innovation for a new type of treatment, say for progressive MS, that we're actually paying attention to, can people get it? And are we making sure that everybody who has progressive MS is included in the trials? And so that we actually have, results that are representative of the entire MS population and not just, you know, sort of the subset that, you know, that would be sort of the scientist's perfect design. And so that's the shift that I'm seeing. And I'm heartened to see that our community is evolving, but also that we're really now starting to think about these access questions in a disciplined manner. And so that's, you know, something that really matters a lot to us as the MS Society and me as one of the staff members responsible for it.
I see that shift for inclusivity and diversity. I think until we can be inclusive in our clinical trials, we cannot possibly have a DMT that can help everybody with multiple sclerosis. So I see that changing as well. And that provides a lot of hope because until we represent everybody, we represent no one.
Exactly.
When you began with the MS Society, I mean, DMTs have changed drastically now with a dozen or so. Development of treatments for progressive MS seems more challenging than DMTs for relapsing MS. And I might not be phrasing this correctly, but what I love is that you're a member of the executive leadership team and the Progressive MS Alliance's Scientific Steering Committee. And the Progressive MS Alliance is driving a lot of effort and hope toward progressive multiple sclerosis. Can you share some of the advances you've seen in progressive MS and perhaps more about the Alliance?
Sure. Well, I'm happy to do that. And, you know, I think you're right. I mean, progressive MS is a significant challenge. And, you know, when I started in the role as the chief research officer for the society about a decade ago now, you know, that was really a big unmet need. We'd heard from so many people with MS who would say to us, you know, it's awesome that we're getting all these DMTs for relapsing MS, but, you know, I feel left behind with progressive MS. You know, what are you doing there? And so what I'm excited about in the current future is that we have some treatments. You know, Ocrevus is here. We have, you know, siponimod is another one that's here. And, you know, we have a few that are coming. We've got more clinical trials coming in progressive MS. So that's positive. And, you know, I am one of those ones who sees the fact that, you know, we have even these very modestly effective, and the doctors will say, you know, this one treatment is a very modestly effective for primary progressive MS. And I'm quick to remind those individuals is that's the exact same thing that was said about betaseron when it was approved in 1993. This is modestly effective. It's only whatever percentage effective was, you know, it's not a breakthrough. It's not as big a deal. But then you would say, you know, that first treatment opened the next set of treatments, which opened the next set of treatments, which then got us better, faster clinical trials. So that now you've got what, almost 20 plus treatments out there for various things, highly effective and even more effective ones coming. Well, I'll take that win of the modestly effective if it opens up the door to what we've seen in relapsing MS, rather than saying, oh, it's not good enough. I think there's a comparison trap that one can fall into to say, well, it's not at here, so really, you know, it's not there. But the point is, we actually have to get those first wins and to start momentum and get the flywheel turning. That's not to say that we don't have big challenges. I mean, the practicality is that, you know, the reason why we were able to get more treatments for relapsing is, one, we were able to understand the disease better and understand the targets that, you know, you would want to go for in the disease to be able to have a treatment that works. But the other thing that really mattered a lot was that we got really effective tools for doing clinical trials fast. You know, when in phase two clinical trials in relapsing MS, your listeners might have heard of this idea of reducing the number of relapses over 6 months or reducing the number of lesions over a 6 month period by MRI is the go, no go decision for doing a phase three clinical trial. That paradigm revolutionized doing clinical trials in relapsing MS. We don't have a similar paradigm in progressive MS. In progressive MS, it really is about measuring how quickly individuals, progress through disability, as we call it, through the EDSS, or now we're starting to see, you know, can you measure a person's brain volume changes over a 2-year period in a clinical trial? 2 years, right, is a long time. I mean, that's what we've been living with in COVID. And I would all say 2 years is a really long time. And in clinical trial years, that's just an enormous barrier for getting treatments. And so that's one of the changes that, you know, we need to focus on is how can we accelerate and get the tools we need to measure changes in a person's body if they have progressive MS more quickly. And so that's one barrier for getting quick treatments more quickly. The other thing I'd say is that we continue to have a barrier to understanding what is happening in progressive MS. Like, when does progression start? How does progression manifest itself, you know, in the brain? It's not manifesting itself by the lesions we normally see. So, you know, how's it showing up? What are the cells that are involved and how progression is triggered? What other factors like age, for example, or the environment or socioeconomic status or other factors like other comorbidities that a person may have, like, you know, if they have diabetes or heart disease or other things, how do those all play into when progression starts in any one person? How does race and ethnicity factor into it? I mean, these are all the factors that we're starting to see in, you know, influence where progression comes to play. And so those are all the things we want to focus on. And in the Progressive MS Alliance, we've actually identified those as pillars to our strategy. You know, one pillar of our strategy is we need to understand progression. We need to get at, you know, when does progression start? How can we intervene? And how do these other factors like race, ethnicity, being on a DMT influence when a person may progress? We need to also get better at doing clinical trials and have the tools we need to conduct clinical trials better, smarter, faster, and to leverage technology. And we've made some investments to get there, but we need to make investments to do more. But then there's a third pillar that we haven't talked about that I think is also just as vital, and that's addressing quality of life, addressing well-being, making sure that as we're trying to find, you know, and get an understanding for the disease, and as we're trying to get better at doing clinical trials, that we also are investing in the science to be able to empower people to live well with, you know, as they live with progressive MS. And that involves, you know, understanding, you know, innovations in rehabilitation and physical medicine and how that can improve somebody's quality of life, addressing things like diet, exercise, well-being, addressing things like mental health, and all of those dimensions, which, you know, are also really important for relapsing MS. I don't want to say that they're not important for relapsing MS because they are, but in progressive MS, those quality of life improvements can also, you know, enable individuals to live powerfully while we get towards getting those treatments that matter. And the good news is that we are making progress in all those areas. You know, through the investments, for example, in the Progressive MS Alliance, we've been able to identify through the work of Dr. Frank Quintana at Harvard that different cells in the immune system known as microglia, which normally play a role as what I call them as the street sweepers of the brain. They play a really important role in helping clear the brain out of all of the junk that might be there. But they also, in the context of progressive MS, might get turned around and actually start doing damage and sort of going up on the sidewalk and tearing up the grass and, you know, creating more damage. And he's focusing on identifying drug treatments that can basically turn that off. And that's one piece. We're focusing on myelin repair strategies through another team. And so I think there is a lot of momentum in progressive MS research, which excites me for the future.
It excites me as well. I think there's so much to quality of life. I go back to that one tenet because as I progress, so much of my life and abilities have changed so drastically. And while I am on a DMT, I see so many aspects of my life that would benefit from medications to help quality of life, pain, mobility, mental health. And I think it's important for us as patients to take up the mantle of responsibility for ourselves and be advocates and take care of ourselves the best we can so that we can meet that need. We can make ourselves the best we possibly can so that DMT can help or communicate with our physician and just learn how to advocate and be very helpful to our own health, because until we can take care of and speak about ourselves, we really can't do anything. We need to be relevant, and each one of us are relevant.
And that's exactly. I mean, each person, right, has agency, and we each play a role in our life. And, you know, I think I see our role through the MS Society and the Progressive MS Alliance of being able to create the environment for you as an individual to have agency in your MS journey, because everyone's MS journey is absolutely unique. And, you know, that also creates opportunities to really walk alongside an individual and create an environment that helps them live powerfully.
That's well said. I think connectivity is so crucial to our quality of life. And I've seen a little bit of that connectivity fragmented due to COVID. Hard, but I notice what you offer at the National MS Society puts us back in touch with one another.
It matters so much. Yeah, COVID has definitely been a disruptor in our life in so many ways.
Sylvia Lowry, the founder of the National MS Society, was an advocate far before her time. And the National MS Society advocates on a myriad of levels, like you have spoken about. And many cannot see these amazing accomplishments. Is there somewhere on your site or a website where someone can go see all that you do?
Sure. Yeah. So actually, if they were to visit our website and go, you know, actually, you have to kind of go down to the part where, you know, it's about our leadership and some of our history and our major accomplishments. You can actually see sort of, you know, our track record of progress. And, you know, I think Sylvia, I did not have the privilege of meeting her. She was an incredible force. I mean, so besides starting the National MS Society, you know, she actually launched the MS International Federation, so the global community of MS societies, you know, and back in the 60s and the 70s, you know, people would write to her from other countries about, how did you start the MS Society? She would write back to them, tell them how she did it. And there was one instance of like the Australian MS Society, when they got their start, they were getting their start. They had written to Sylvia, because back in those days, right, you know, snail mail. And so she wrote back to them. And basically said, well, you know, one of our ambassadors is part of this basketball team and they're going to be touring Australia. Well, why don't you get connected with them? And that started things rolling. And there's a couple of things that I'd say about Ms. Lowry that just were so remarkable. You know, one of the things is that, you know, when she put that two-line ad in the New York Times in 1945, you know, the aspiration she had that, you know, she did not accept the diagnosis that her brother Bernard had been given of like, you know, put your affairs in order, go home to die. There's nothing we can do for you. You know, she refused to accept that. If you think about the time, it was 1945, polio was in the midst of, you know, being cured. So she was good friends with Basil O'Connor, who was actually the head of the National Foundation, now the March of Dimes, who discovered Jonas Salk. And so the realm of possibility was something that she took as a given. And she was very passionate. And then, you know, they started the ARMS, as they were called, the American Association for something in MS, Research in MS was called, and then became the MS Society. But then to take it globally, and, you know, to this day, one of the things we as the MS Society, the US National MS Society, have always said is, we will go anywhere we need to go to find the cure for MS. And that goes all the way back to Sylvia. So when people raise money, and it doesn't just stay in the United States, it goes where it needs to go. And that has led to, for example, we've trained more than 1,000 people who are now researchers and physicians. So I'm a product of the Society's Fellowship Program. Bruce Bebo, my colleague who heads up our research, he was an alumnus of our fellowship program. Dr. Steve Hauser, who is well known for developing Ocrevus, he had a fellowship and several important development awards from the society. You know, the leaders in the community who are developing new treatments had fellowships from the MS Society. Dr. Nadi Karen, who invented Tysabri, basically, did that when he was a fellow funded by the National MS Society. And so we're very proud of the fact that, you know, when we make these investments in people, we're investing in the next generation and, you know, creating possibility around the world for us to get new discoveries. Sylvia was also very instrumental in helping establish the Neurological Institute at the, so that there, you know, for your listeners, there's the National Institutes of Health. We probably all know it from Dr. Fauci, right? He leads the infectious disease one, but there's also one focused on neurological diseases. It's called the National Institute for Neurological Diseases and Stroke. They fund about a couple billion dollars worth of brain research, and of that, MS is a big, has a significant contributions. When Sylvia, you know, we did not have a neurology institute in the 50s, but she partnered with Lou Gehrig's wife, as well as other leaders, to get the legislation passed through to create the neurological, the what became NINDS, as we call it for shorthand. And so that kind of advocacy win. We were very involved in, you know, the passage of the Affordable Care Act, which brought healthcare and reduced many of the uncertainties for people with MS. I remember that time, controversial, but, you know, so many people with MS, right, struggled with MS as a pre-existing condition, yourself included, right? It was like, it was so transformational for people. And we're proud to be part of that. And, you know, we're proud to be part of the passage of the ADA. We really were involved in that. That was before my time at the MS Society, but in talking to colleagues, you know, that was a big, big deal that we were involved with. And so, you know, what we're proud of as a society is, you know, we're well known for doing research and investing in a lot of research and having made investments in the early research that's led to all of the existing disease modifying treatments. But really for us, it goes beyond that, right? It is about having a network, a nationwide network of activists that are activating at the state and federal level to really bring policy change. You know, when doctors weren't prescribing the disease modifying therapies, we took positions that said, you have to prescribe these disease modifying therapies. I mean, we took a stand. We've taken stands on stem cells, which I know was controversial at the time, but we took a stand and said, no, you know, we cannot be inhibiting the science. We, as you probably know, we've taken a stand on the price of drugs, which hasn't won us a lot of friends in some, but, you know, I think the point was not so much to be, you know, confrontational about it, but to say, you know, if you think about people with MS and the all of the costs associated with living with the disease, you know, so often people underestimate, you know, yes, a 10% copay on a $70,000 a year drug, a lot of money for people. And so those are all the kinds of things that, you know, we're really involved with that help, you know, change lives in ways that we're proud of.
You've been a touchstone to so many changes. And I was not aware of how many, but it's awe-inspiring, truly. And speaking of pre-existing conditions, truly, that was a game changer. And myself, having fought my own myself for a DMT I could not get through my provider, I went all the way up the chain. I wrote letters. I went before a committee. I went there and I got it. And I encourage people to fight. And if they need a navigator and they need help with that fight, to contact the National MS Society, because they will help you fight. And I don't like that word, but I encourage advocacy for yourself again, because it's hard when you're tired and you're scared and somebody huge is telling you you owe $70,000 for a drug. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But change can happen. Change is in your hands. Try. And exactly. It's powerful. And anyway, to me, it's very emotional because I've seen it happen, and I've also seen it not happen. So, but you don't know until you try.
Exactly. I mean, each person, right, is on their journey. And, you know, I think we're here, as you say, we're here to advocate. Our benefits and employment team is here to support individuals across the journey, as you say. And, you know, each person's story is unique, but that also gives us the opportunity to help, you know, one person at a time, making a difference. That's what we're
Absolutely.
About.
And the patient journey is so crucial. Each journey is unique, but each journey is embraced by your organization as seen as equitable. And that is very appreciated. What do you see as the next, I mean, this is such a loaded question, but what do you see as the next groundbreaking discovery? If I know that's just like, thanks, Jen, I don't have 2 hours.
But... Yes, yes. Thank you for setting a low bar for me.
So I'll
take a couple stabs at that. So, you know, I think, you know, in the future, based on the science for funding and the way the direction we're going, we're not far off having those blood tests and those MRI tests that let the doctors have a more intentional conversation with an individual that says, okay, here's what I'm seeing based on your lab tests. Let's adjust this medication. Maybe you might want to consider this strategy. I think that's the future we're getting to. And I see also a future where, while we've had, you know, some challenges in getting those treatments that can promote myelin repair, I do see a future where we're going to have those treatments that would be taken alongside a DMT that would be focused on protecting the brain, preserving the brain. We call them neuroprotective agents. We're doing some funding, some clinical trials that are looking at that in the UK. But I see a future where there's a bit of a cocktail of treatments that it's a stop the immune system, protect the brain from damage. And then sort of next generation beyond that, then will be, you know, those treatments that get right at, you know, what's causing nerve cells to die in the brain. We have to figure out how to get those drugs into the brain. We'll figure that out. But this is where research in diseases like Alzheimer's actually will be super helpful, because there's so much investment being made in the Alzheimer's disease area. And they have the same problem that we do in MS of, you've got to get that into the brain. But what they learn from Alzheimer's will be able to apply to MS and vice versa. So that's, you know, sort of at the science level. I also see in the future, you know, we've got better and better treatments that stop the disease and inflammation in its tracks earlier. I think we're going to get better at detecting MS earlier and earlier in the disease process, and having these treatments that stop the disease really early, and then, you know, people have a different trajectory with their disease. And that's, I think, important. For the society, one of the things that we're really focused on is, we have heard from far, far too many people about how long it has taken for them to get diagnosed, to get the confirmed diagnosis. I mean, I've heard about, you know, these diagnostic sagas that people go on trying to figure out what it is. And some of that has to do with, you know, they're not necessarily with the doctor who's skilled in diagnosing MS. So then they look a lot of different things. You know, some cases are complicated, so we have to, you know, allow for that. But we're really focused on what do we need to do to get individuals diagnosed correctly and more efficiently and quicker, so that they can then start taking the steps they need and not sort of, you know, living with this uncertainty. So I see, you know, diagnosing MS is becoming faster, quicker, more efficient. And then I'd say for progressive MS, you know, I think we've started the flywheel turning of getting those treatments coming. And I think that the next sort of sets of scientific insights we'll see is, can we get at identifying, you know, what are the factors that will be a tipping point for a person potentially, you know, starting progression or starting to progress more rapidly? And then what can we do to intervene? We're not quite at the point of being able to say that with predictive power, but I see that will then begin to change the dynamics, so that if a person hears the words, you have MS, you can then have a conversation with the doctor about, okay, what does the prognosis look like? What are the steps we can take? And then for me, ultimately, the ultimate would be, you know, can we get even earlier in the process and say, what are the, before someone is even in the stage of potentially having MS, can we figure out what are those risk factors and intervene to change that? I mean, the doctors believe that we can get to that. It's, you know, I don't want folks to feel like, you know, I'm sort of over, you know, excessively hopeful, but, you know, when I talk to the epidemiologists, those are the scientists that talk about sort of, you know, public health perspectives around disease, you know, they increasingly say, you know, if we can address things, if we could understand how things like low vitamin D, exposure to Epstein-Barr virus, potentially a person's genetic makeup, all of those things interplay with each other to leave a person susceptible to MS. If we can sort out how each of those figure out, we can then start to get a strategy for intervening to say, okay, let's get at it earlier. And so, you know, could we end MS forever? I think the answer is yes. I think we need to understand a lot more about these, and don't press me on a timetable, but I see that, you know, the developments in the science in each of those areas is there. And what we need to now do as a community is come together, scientific community, and say, okay, fine, we have all these things. Now, how do we help doctors have the conversation with people who might be at risk? What should they look for? What should they be paying attention to? And that is a radical change from the kinds of conversations we would have had 20 years ago when I joined the MS Society.
Well, Tim, as someone who is excessively hopeful, I really value all of those answers, because I have bad days, but I have a good life. And I encourage people who are having those bad days to just try to listen into the hope of the future. And we are grateful for the work you're doing at the National MS Society, Tim.
Thank you. I think hope is really important and it's critical. And so I'll join you in being excessively hopeful, because I believe that, you know, we've made so much progress in the time that I've been a part of the MS community since getting my doctorate. And, you know, really, it's a privilege to be one with you and your listeners and to really be part of this community. It means so much.
Well, thank you for joining us. And I'm going to give you the last word, but with what words would you like to leave our listeners? I'll leave it to you. Anything you want. Bar very low.
Easy questions. You know, I think I would just come back to, you know, the conversation earlier we had around the importance of agency and each person having, you know, agency in their life and understanding that each of us is on a journey. We at the Society are here to support individuals as they're walking through that journey, but also to be, you know, I would say to your listeners, you know, that the landscape of MS has changed profoundly over the last 20 years and is continuing to change, and to not lose hope that, you know, we are, you know, our community, our scientists and clinicians and doctors and people affected by MS are all really coming together in ways that are really unprecedented. It's a privilege to be part of that and to really see how the landscape has changed, and to also see how each of us can play a role in that in our own way. And so, again, I just, you know, encourage individuals to continue to, you know, embrace their agency and take ownership and find community. But definitely, as you say, you know, find community, however you find community, to, so, you know, and to really not lose sight of the fact that, you know, the journey of MS is changing and will continue to change. And we are looking forward to changing that so that those MS journeys can come to an end at some point in the future.
Tim Coetzee, Chief Advocacy of Services and Science Officer at the National MS Society. It has certainly been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us at MS News Today.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for listening to the Multiple Sclerosis News Today podcast. I'm your host, Jen Powell. Share your thoughts on this episode through social media. You can find MS News Today on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Follow us to keep updated on the latest news and to never miss new content and initiatives. Click the links in this episode's description.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to Multiple Sclerosis News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.multiplesclerosisnewstoday.com.